Welcome back to the Fried Egg Podcast and Open Championship Week. This week's podcast and open coverage is brought to you by our friends at Greater Than. Greater Than is the healthiest sports drink on the market and delivers two times the electrolytes with half the sugars of their leading competition. It's my favorite sports drink to have while on or off the course. Check out Greater Than at drinkgt.com and use the promo code THEFRIEDEGG with no spaces to get 20% off your first order. The easiest way to get Greater Than and the way I get it is to sign up for their subscription service. It gets delivered monthly, and if you sign up this week, you will get a free fried egg hat with your subscription. That's drinkgt.com, and without any further delay, here's our open preview with Sean Martin and Brendan Porath.
The fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing. Playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. Not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I am joined by Brendan Porath of SB Nation and Sean Martin of the PGA Tour to break down this week's Open Championship. Welcome on, guys.
Andy, having us back.
Am I your first international guest in Fried Egg history?
Yeah, Sean Martin coming from live on the ground. But no, we've had international guests. We've had Mike Clayton from Australia.
That's
Richie Ramsey from Scotland.
Yeah.
So
nice of you to be able to get out of an airport terminal for this one, Sean.
Happy to fit you in. I've been here for 9 days, so I'm well in Scottish life. Ask me anything.
So you're respecting audio. You know, this is a rare appearance for you, not in either a media center or airport.
Yeah, I hate the sound of my own voice, so I haven't listened back to the Shinnecock one, but I definitely kind of want to just to hear what that airport sounded like in that podcast.
Yeah.
Only psychotic, vain people listen to the podcasts they're on or video.
I don't know how people do it.
Yeah, you have to be psychotic.
So, Sean, how is it as baked out as everybody's saying? What to give us some reporting from the ground? What can you tell us?
It is, and we got some little sprinkles this morning. So I think, and Tiger kind of talked about that we're not quite at the point where we were. There was talk of like DJ driving it into the burn on 18, which is 450 yards, but you're getting guys talking about hitting 330. I mean, it's rolling out forever. I mean, it's going to be the story of this Open. There should be, if you're having your Open bingo or Open drinking game, I think Hoylake or Liverpool definitely has to feature prominently on the board, because there's going to be tons of comparisons to that. A lot of hope for people who want to see Tiger win, that he can kind of repeat that performance. And so there are a lot of similarities there. I think that you're going to see a lot of irons off the tees. You might see guys not hit driver at all for the week. It definitely, a lot depends on the wind too. I was sharing the train home with a caddy, and he was talking about how downwind, the ball it does launch once it hits the fairway. But really, if you're into even a little bit of wind, it really holds it up pretty well and doesn't roll nearly as much. I don't have my exact wind gauge on me, but I feel like walking around some days in the morning and the afternoon, the wind does switch enough where holes can play downwind in the morning and into wind in the afternoon. So it's just, there's a lot of variables at play, as there always are at the Open Championship, and I think that's definitely going to be part of it this week.
Yeah, the weather looks pretty good for the week. So it doesn't, from what I've seen, it doesn't look like there's going to be one of those crazy Open Championship days yet. But with, you know, pretty good weather conditions, you might escape that possibility of one side of a draw getting like an unbelievably huge advantage over the other side.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of wind in the forecast. I think like 15 miles an hour is the most. And then Friday, a little like occasional rain, as they put it, in the mornings, about the extent of the rain. So it's going to be good for ice cream sales. It's going to be good for equity of the draw. So it should be a pretty good, well-rounded Open Championship.
So Brendan, what are you watching for? Do you have any random facts you remember from the last time the Open was at Carnoustie also?
Huh. I don't know. I'm trying to think. You want like random drama or random beefs? I think the thing I loved most about the last time at Carnoustie was Rory's outfit. You know, I go to the scripting, but he was, you know, an amateur at the time. He was doing the deep V-neck button-up cardigan, you know, with the floppy hair. It's just interesting to think about how far we've come in only 11 years, and now he's kind of the ripped guy in the Nike Blade collars and the assortment of athletic gear.
That was your favorite version of Rory, Fat Rory.
Yeah, it was like he was like pudgy Rory, kind of on his way out of Fat Rory. Really a nice medium, happy medium there. So hadn't quite, you know, he hadn't turned pro yet and made the money to kind of plump up, you know, but just kind of innocent, pudgy amateur Rory.
So while we're talking about Rory, what do you guys think? Do you think he's got majors in him? I mean, is the putter that big of a problem?
I don't know, man. I still have a little bit of Jack Shinnecock was so jarring. I mean, he was out. The U.S. Open was basically over for him at like 10 a.m. Thursday. We were all riding that high of he wins at Bay Hill and he plays in the final group of the Masters, and obviously a very heartbreaking loss, but had played well for the most part, and then just comes out at Shinnecock, and it's just, I mean, was he 9 over after 9, 10 over after 10? It was jarring, and I mean, the Rory story is always plays well in soft conditions, and I just feel like that exacerbated that storyline, because it was firm, it was fast, and it was a very early ejection that I can't recover from it yet, and I can't quite take him this week.
His putter at Travelers now 2 years in a row has been insane. How poor it has been. It must be something about those greens, because like, what was it, last year he went through 3 putter changes in a week, and then this year he was, I think, 72nd in strokes gained putting for the week, and you know, he's by far, like, I think he was 3 shots clear of the next person in strokes gained tee to green. So I don't know. It's just a matter of everything kind of coming together. But if he puts field average, he's going to be in the top 5, you know?
Yep.
It's just getting him to put field average.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my discussion of his sweater brought us here. But, yeah, I just think he's kind of a I don't know, not a bit player. He never is. But he's just, like, a part of the crowd this week, I would say. I'm not, like... I think, you know, obviously there's always, he's one of the top 10 players in the world. There's always the potential for him to contend. I don't know that he's putting well enough. He seems like he's working through a lot of different things and trying to go back to his like more natural swing he talks about in 09, you know, Fat Rory swing. You know, things aren't always bad when you got some extra weight on you. So, it seems like he's just kind of trying to figure out some things. So I think he's just kind of part of a larger group that's worth talking. Maybe not sticking out as much as he does at, you know, the Masters, where we have that natural storyline we always want to talk about, and some of the others.
What storyline are you guys watching? Like, what storyline are you buying most this week? Which is your favorite one?
Go ahead, Sean.
Non-Hideki division. I do love that Hideki Tiger Rue Knox pairing. I'm all in on Russell Knox. The last Scottish win in the Open came at Carnoustie in 1999. Two of the last 3 Scottish winners were at Carnoustie. I just think a guy who is playing very well, he's on a good run of form. He hits it dead straight, and the course is going to play short. I just have high hopes for Rue Knox. I know it's not like one of the major storylines. We're getting pretty off topic here. We're going to start talking about probably the Eastern Amateur next or something. But I'm in on that. And then I think I'm in on Brooks. I mean, Shinnecock was firm and fast. And I think winning at Shinnecock, I don't know that Brooks ever doubted his ability. He's full of confidence. But I think winning at Shinnecock, I think, showed all of us a lot, and I would think showed him a lot too, that, I mean, he already knew he could play majors. It's now 11 straight majors where 21st or better, but I mean, I feel like if it's really firm, really fast, we saw what Brooks did at Shinnecock. I think it's going to be all about iron play, and I think, you know, I think Brooks is a name to watch, and if he did, that'd be three majors.
I feel like the firm conditions might mitigate distance a little and the distance advantage. I think you'll see, I mean, he guy like Zach Johnson all of a sudden has a chance. I love Molinari with the way he's playing. But what about Hideki? No top 10 since Hawaii.
Yeah, caddy changed this week apparently too, according to my friends in the Japanese media. So a little shake up in Camp Hideki, trying to mix things up a little bit. I don't know. He had the heartbreaking loss at the PGA. Then he had the wrist injury. Wrist injuries are hard to come back from. Shaken confidence from the PGA, and I could just see. You know, it's been a dark time in Hideki land. But I like Molinari a lot and Knox. Both those guys hit it so dead straight. But as firm as it is too, and he's side spin on the ball, and the ball is going to bounce anywhere. So Rue and Francesco, two of the hottest players in the world, and really two of the straightest players in the world. So I'm also all in on those picks.
I mean, I think the biggest story, you know, we're sitting here on Tuesday, is going to be the course, and is the course, and it's hard to say that with Tiger in the field too. But I just, I think like in all the lead up days, this is just so extreme and different from what we're used to, even for the Open, and like I hate to play into the line of baked out, you know, you're going to hear that every 3 minutes, and you're going to hear every synonym for it used throughout the weekend. I'm like fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by seeing the best in the world try and play it, figure out how to play it. It seems like we're getting, for me, like the biggest storyline is that there seems to be a really clear cut like divergence of strategies. We hear Rory and DJ and Rom and some of these other big hitters saying like, well, it's burned out. The burned out effect for them is that the rough is now wispy and they feel like they can play out of it. That may be kind of a poor strategy, but that's the way they're thinking. So they're going to bomb it over everything and they're not worried about missing, you know, the fairway. You know, of course there are different parts of missed fairways that are worse than others, but they just feel like the burned outness of it has made it more of a bomber's paradise, I guess, this week. And then there's the other track of, you know, strategy, like a Spieth saying, I'm just going to, you know, Greller thinks I can just hit four irons all day. And you know, I just really find that so fascinating. We don't see this. We don't see a course deliberately like this so often. And the way it's really, and there seems to be no uniform response to how to play it.
Yeah, I think Carnoustie's been known as the toughest Open Championship course for a long time, one of the toughest venues in all of golf, and it kind of is that way because of how narrow it is. But you know, with the distance thing and it being thinner and the wispy long stuff, that actually might, you know, take some of the teeth out of the golf course, where I, you know, remember growing up watching at Carnoustie, like 99, like,
yeah,
that if you missed the fairway, it was just dead. And if it's a little bit thinner and it's going to be a little more unpredictable, but at the end of the day, I think when you've got a wedge in your hand, it's a lot less, you know, challenging, and it's the longest golf course in the Open Rota, and obviously the firm conditions will make it play much, much, much shorter. So, I mean, I imagine with what I've been seeing, the course is, you know, 7,400 yards, probably playing 6,700 yards, and if you know adjusted it for how firm and fast it is, right, Sean?
The thing that kind of helps with the whole bomb and gouge mentality is that the greens are very green. They've kept them very healthy. You know, I think we saw at St. Andrews in 2015 what happens if they get the greens a little too speedy. Then all of a sudden, you know, 20, 25 mile an hour wind gust comes, and which isn't too uncommon here, and you got to stop play. So that'll take out some of the necessity to play to angles. But I talked to Russell today, Russell Knox, and he said he thinks that angles are going to be big this week, and that Carnoustie you know, walking around today, it's the way it's bunkered. There always seems to be two. A lot of times, there's two sets of bunkers that you might be able to carry one, but then you're bringing the other one into play. And guys might be able to do what Spieth did last year, where you're intentionally aiming at the rough because, you know, the rough is maybe a quarter shot penalty, maybe even less. While as a pop bunker, especially here, where they seem to be the deepest pop bunkers I've ever seen at a links course, is maybe a one shot penalty or at least three quarters of a shot. But I don't know. You can't roll around this place without abandon, even with the rough being wispy. You know, Russell talked about a really experienced links player he thinks is going to win here. And when you look, you know, Padraig won here. He's a links player. Paul Laurie from Scotland won here. I think four of the seven winners here have been from the British Isles. Tom Watson won here. He was a master of links. So I think that, I don't know, I don't think Carnoustie, even in these conditions, allows guys to just kind of play with impunity. I think that you'll see a lot of driving irons and I don't know. It seemed hard for me. I'm not one of the top players in the world, but it seemed hard for me to walk around today to just see opportunities for guys to just blow it all over the place.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what I'm kind of watching and what I've been thinking about a little bit is, you know, we've had all the slew of first time major winners, and obviously Brooks has been kind of the first of that crop to get the second major title. Like, we have Dustin Johnson. You look at down the world rankings, Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas, Justin Rose, top three players, all only have one major championship. Then you go, you know, you've got Jason Day, you've got Patrick Reed, you've got Henrik Stenson, Sergio, all first time, you know, one time major winners. And I think there's a big, you know, opportunity for these guys to, you know, separate themselves and put them into another pantheon with a second major win. And what you were just describing made me kind of think of, like, you know, great links player that hasn't won an Open Championship is Sergio.
Yeah. Sergio, little runner up here in 07, a little heartbreak. Mm-hmm. But also too, like, going back to the stats, five of the seven winners here are in the Hall of Fame, and that doesn't include Padraig, who's going to get in. So basically six of the seven players who've won here are Hall of Famers. I think we're going to get a class winner, so I think that kind of falls into what you're saying.
I'm a big Koepka guy again. I can't, you know, I don't know that I'll pick him back-to-back, but from a link standpoint, I kind of like Fleetwood. He seems, you know, based on what we saw at Shinnecock, I don't know if he's, like, as linksy a player as, like, a
course record holder at Carnoustie.
Yeah, yep, but obviously a different kind of course. I keep saying you'll hear that once or twice. Yeah, I think of the Euro group, Fleetwood's kind of, that's not really a trendy or a dark horse pick, but he's the one guy I like on the English side. And Knox, I mean, I've seen you've been tweeting all week about Russell Knox, Sean, and it took you, you know, less than 10 minutes to get into him today, but you know, it's kind of hard to ignore his form really through that, like, Rolex series run and everything, you know, the links portion of the schedule. So I think Knox and Fleetwood are my two favorite Euros.
So we got a question from Kyle Davis who's asked, is the Open the best overall major when you take into consideration TV coverage, rota courses, the RNA setup, and, you know, just links golf, all that comes with it? What do you guys think about that?
It is for me. And I wrote this a couple of years ago and kind of reheat it and update it every year. I don't know I think the modern Open, and I'll say maybe the last decade, has really branded itself really well. I just think it's really distinct, and this is a personal opinion. So my personal interaction with this championship just seems more meaningful than others. I don't know why. Like, I just feel like I remember more often of, like, where I was, and remember taking it in more when it was whatever Tiger in 2005 or Tiger in 2000 or, you know, Phil in 2013, Rory in 2014. I just remember more about my personal interaction with this tournament. Just feels extra special. I like all the others too. I love the Masters. I love the US Open for a very different reason than this. But I think just there's so many things about this, the TV coverage, this time change, which I think is really, really fun for a US audience for 1 week a year. It's not fun. This isn't something we want to do regularly. I think it's I think that actually plays into the identity of the tournament for a U.S. audience. And then obviously just the style of golf. It's so refreshing. We're going to Belrive in 3 weeks or whatever. It's just, it's nice to know that you can rely on this. And this may be a kind of a, you know, this may be even an extreme case for firm and fast, but you just know the visual of it is going to be so different from what we're used to. And I just think like the way it's really, the RNA has branded it over the last decade. They're very, very consistent and specific and clean. And I just think that they put on the best championship.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in California, so I think, you know, your final group was teeing off at like 7 a.m. And, sure. And so it was pretty awesome. It was so early. I mean, you could watch the whole thing and then, you know, it's over by like before noon and you could go play golf. So I always have fond memories of that kind of, it's cool too, cause you can get up early, and just watch the golf and kind of curl up on the couch. And I definitely have a lot of fun memories of that. And when Lynx golf is so unique, Tiger today was like beaming talking about the first time he played Carnoustie, when he played as an amateur in the Scottish Open, and talking about how he spent 2 hours just hitting all these different clubs to the 100-yard sign, and he putted from 80 yards. And I mean, it was like the biggest smile, I mean, that I'd seen on his face and maybe ever. And I think part of that was just kind of recalling his youth and time with his dad, and back when golf was a more innocent pursuit and he wasn't being hounded by everyone and everyone snapping photos of him with cell phone cameras and stuff. But I think also just, you know, you tweeted the thing that he had from Chronicles of an Open Champion. And I think people like just like seeing that challenge, they like playing in that challenge. It's just so different. It's so unique that, yeah, I think the uniqueness of it, I think it's awesome.
I'd strongly recommend going and finding that clip of Tiger. I'm sure it's on like golfchannel.com or someplace like that that has the press conferences. Tiger talking about his first time at Carnoustie, which was what, 95? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, 90. In an amateur event. It just hitting that 100-meter sign. He's like, I just stayed there for 2 hours. I hit 9 irons to it. I hit 5 irons. I hit wedges to it. And my dad was like, are you ever going to hit it past the 100-meter sign? He's like, no, this is so much fun. And he was just smiling the whole time. And I think he went on a soliloquy for, I don't know, like 3 minutes just talking about it. I just would strongly recommend. I know I'm kind of restating what Sean said, but I would strongly recommend just because there was so much context, his like facial expressions and smiling around it was really cool to hear him talk about the style.
Yeah, I think the Open is another example of why variety is so important for golf, like whether it be the type of golf you're playing or, you know, the type of players on a leaderboard or, you know, even a golf course within a golf course having variety. But, you know, the Open Championship gives us a completely different look and feel from every other tournament that we, you know, as Americans are conditioned to watch. And if you look at the last, you know, I was talking with Will Knights, who writes for the site, and he does these, you know, ranking the last 10, you know, ranking the last decade pieces for majors. And we were talking about the Open Championship and just like how many memorable ones there have been. I mean, last year you had, you know, Jordan yelling at Greller, go get that. But then the year before you had the Stenson-Mickelson duel. I mean, you have like, you know, Zach Johnson, Leishman, and Oosthuizen in a playoff the year before that at St. Andrews. But then you had like Stuart Sink and Tom Watson going at it. Well, you know, like maybe one of the most memorable Opens. And, you know, you had Phil at Muirfield. That was a great Open. Like in the last decade, you know, there have been so many great Open championships. And I think more so than every other tournament, they've been the most memorable tournament of recent memory.
Yeah, I just, and for like different reasons, I feel like, you know, the last decade, there's just, like I was saying, my personal interaction with it, I just remember so much about each one. Like Phil, there was like that triumphalism of just feeling like I just played the best round of my life. And it kind of came out of nowhere. That wasn't like a ton of hype. He was in, you know, among the last 4 or 5 groups, and it just happened. And then all of a sudden it was over. You know, he wasn't even in the coverage until like the ninth hole. And all of a sudden, you know, 2 hours later, he played the round of his life. And so often with Phil, there's so much hype and buildup in a full day. And Rory was different. You know, Rory was great, you know, more because of like it was the full package of Rory. He was hitting freaking lasers, you know, five irons into par fives and making eagle. And it was so different. Like, it was the dominance of Rory that we thought was going to be like the number one, you know, the post Tiger player. Mm-hmm. I just feel like, and you talk about Sink versus Tom Watson, or the year after it's Spieth kind of challenging for the slam and somehow Zach Johnson win. There's just like, it's memorable for a lot of different reasons. And it's been on kind of an incredible run, which kind of scares me also that we're due for kind of a dud or a flop winner. So
from RJ Tapist, could we see the firmness at Carnoustie make a play to a point where minus 15 is a winning score? You know, we all know par doesn't matter, but could it make Carnoustie easier?
I don't know. I mean, I'm still of the mindset that it's going to be a higher winning score. I mean, Padraig shot 7-under when the place was basically almost winless. It was damp. It was playing about as easy as it can, and 7-under won. I just think, I mean, this is a very unique set of circumstances, but the layout is just tough enough that I think even with this, it'll stand up.
Yeah. I think I saw today the over-under for low round is, what, 63.5?
Yeah, I think you tweeted those, and I immediately just wanted to reply over in all caps on everything, just over everything.
Okay, I saw them in my email. I think people are expecting, you know, someone to go super low. I don't know if you can back that up to 2 days in a row or post, you know, four mid-60s rounds, high 60s rounds. But it just seems like everyone's expecting this to be benign.
Yeah, the fact that the greens are kind of soft, but I feel like those greens could bake out real quick. I mean, and actually one of the difficult things is if those fairways are as firm as everybody's saying, so they're really firm fairways, if the greens are soft, those are actually really tough conditions to play in, is when you got a lot of inconsistency between the fairway and the green. And I think, I have a hard time seeing, you know, 16, 17 under, but it, I mean, if anything, with the low wind, sunny, you know, good conditions, like this would be the year that would happen. Granted, par doesn't really matter, you know.
Right.
So, what about the burn naming water features? You know, this comes from Barry W. You guys think it's overrated, underrated? You know, the Barry Burn, Ray's Creek.
I mean, just because it's not like someone came along and like named these for like a postcard. Right. Like, they're historical bodies of water. It's not like they just. This wasn't like a branding exercise. There's a town of Barry nearby, the Barry Mill. Its water wheel is powered by the Barry Burn. So it's not like, you know, just some marketer came by and was like, all right, we need to name this burn after Manilow or Bonds or Sanders. It's just, I don't know. You can't criticize a historic water monument that was probably around before the golf course.
Yeah, I think it's fine. It's underrated if the thing's been there forever. It's not, you know, some sort of, you know, live under par activation or something like that.
So. Plus, how good is it that the thing is 12 feet wide and it messes with people so much? Like, you feel like you could jump across it if you got a running start, and yet it plays a huge part in your thinking on several holes. And a lot of great golf courses do that. I think Cal Club has a great creek on one of the holes, and just shows you don't need a giant pond with a fountain. You can have a great hazard that's 12 feet wide.
So how many times is it cross?
I think it's three times on 18 alone, right?
Yeah. So the course kind of goes along the perimeter of the property. This is not like a traditional out and back links. It goes around basically the square of the property for the most part. And then on the inside is the other course, the burn side. And so you kind of see it on 10. It's not really in play. 10's a pretty short hole. And it's short enough from the green that's not really being played, but you basically see it. You first see it kind of left of 16, which is a 250 yard par three that you're trying to squeeze like a fairway would in between two huge bunkers that are 15 yards apart. And the hole just looks impossible, but really it's 17 where it comes into play. It the thing is like a snake. It goes up the left. It goes in front of the 17th tee, right before the landing area. Then it goes up the left side. Then it crosses again. And so really, the hole, if you go down the left side, I mean, the burn's right there, and there's basically no rough, and you can go in it pretty easily. If you want to try to hit it up on the hole, the burn crosses like kind of a diagonal left to right, so you can try to squeeze it up the right side. But if you pull it or hook it, trying to squeeze it into that right corner, you can easily go in the burn. And then 18, it's not really in play off the tee. You'd have to really snipe one because the rough left of 18 is really, really thick. It's the by far the thickest part of the golf course. I saw Adam Hadwin lose a ball in the rough. And so it is in play in front of the green. I forgot, I was watching Golf Channel documentary on 99 that Paul Laurie bounced it over the burn in regulation. Like, we talk about Vandeveld and all that stuff, but Laurie got this humongous break just to get in that playoff.
Hey, you know, Smartin, you're on site, so you're adjusted to Scottish time. Brendan, what's your schedule? What do you think about adjusting your schedule this year? I know we did last year the stay up all night thing, and that was pretty crazy. But what are you planning on this week?
Well, I'm gonna stay up. I mean, I'm gonna be ready, locked in 1:30 a.m. Eastern on Thursday. But there are many different theories.
Energy drinks.
The strategy. Well, that's certainly an aid. There's many strategies on how to flip into open time for, you know, unemployed or oddly employed people who don't have any obligations Thursday or Friday. I think the thing to do is one of these nights you just have to power through and kind of stay up all night and then like flip and go to bed at like 8 p.m. Scottish time. So like, I think usually the thing, or if you don't have to be working during it, you know, Wednesday night, you pick like you go out to a late dinner, like 10 o'clock. Obviously nothing crazy. Don't like go out for ribs or a bunch of, you know, pasta that's going to knock you out. Go out for a light dinner, maybe light seafood, late Wednesday night. Maybe you have a cocktail or two, kind of like, you know, start feeling good. And then you just power through Thursday and crash. You know, you can switch from cocktails to coffee at some point, usually like 4 or 5. You know, you get that star power group coming in around 4. I think this year it's Spieth coming on at 4.
Yeah, I think there's another one right behind him too. You got Spieth and Rahm and Ricky.
Okay. Phil's pretty early. Phil's like at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
You like switch to coffee kind of around that time, and you just power through to like early afternoon. So you here's my suggestion. You nap a little when you get home from Wednesday work, late dinner Wednesday, couple cocktails, power through. You flipped coffee about like 4 o'clock as those big groups come on, and you get to, you know,
I know where this is headed.
You don't eat heavy. You can't be eating heavy. You can't be having this big breakfast and all that crap.
When do you pop in a Monster, and what flavor do you go with?
That's, I've been waiting 5 minutes for this.
Like a casual sipping. That's just ever present. I think like you should shotgun one at 10 a.m. basically. Like inhale it at 10 a.m. chase it with like an espresso, and then you're good to go.
Jeez,
man.
And then you're good to go. Have a light lunch, maybe like a grilled cheese or something light, not too heavy on the bread or cheese, and you're good. You get to like 4 or 5 o'clock, you crash around 5 p.m. and you're good for the next 3 days.
Do you say goodbye to your wife and kids before you do
that's understood. Yeah.
That's now that we've gotten Brendan's breakdown of his recipe for Open Championship success, it's important to point out one major flaw, a lack of hydration. One of the keys to having energy is staying hydrated, and there's no better way to do that than with our Open Championship sponsor, Greater Than. It's a healthy and delicious sports drink with 2 times the electrolytes of its competition. Buy Greater Than at drinkgt.com and use the promo code THEFRIEDEGG with no spaces to get 20% off your order. Now back to the podcast. And I don't know what I'm going to do this year. I'm probably going to do a super early wake up. Probably like I'm probably going to clock in at 4 a.m. You know, I'm not going to go through the all night thing. And, you know, to be honest, I'm not that excited to watch like Sandy Lyle tee off. Like, doesn't do it for me.
That's the dirty secret about this. It's like that first year they started it at 1:30, which is like insanely early even for Scotland. You know, like it's insanely early in the actual time zone where the tournament is being played. And it was Colin Montgomery at Troon and all that, you know, stuff. But like, it's kind of quiet until like 3 or 4. Like, yeah. ESPN would come on at 4 o'clock on Thursday and Friday.
I mean, I'm pretty excited about the 208 pairing of Mark Calcavecchia, Dante Bumna, and Sean Norris. Is that Norris or Norris?
I think it's Norris, isn't it?
Is it Norris? I've got it in front of me. It's spelled with two O's and one R.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Maybe it's a misspell.
Well, I got to be honest. I might need. They have a different energy drink for sale in the media center. It's one sponsored by a top 10 player in the world. Won't name names, but I may need one. I haven't had a good night's sleep since I got here. The whole not getting dark until past 10 and then getting light again at 4 a.m. It really messes with you, and I'm going about 9 days now without quality sleep. So I may have to follow your own plan though.
What do you guys think about the pairings for the Open?
The field. I lost you there.
Yeah, I lost everybody there. I said, what do you guys think about the pairings with the non? You know, they're kind of stacked, but not super stacked. Do you like this?
I'll go. I liked Kyle's take. I thought Kyle, our friend Kyle Porter of CBS, of course, was spot on. I think that the kind of two-thirds groups where it's like two big names and you know the third name that they really could slot in there to make it just a super group, they don't go there. They just have two really big names and a lesser one. I like that for just the overall flow, especially if you're someone like Brendan or you know, you guys getting up at like 2 in the morning. They're kind of just sprinkled throughout the tee times. And, you know, I was going through, I did our feature groups file for PGTour.com, and I did like 10 groups because there were so many that you had to pay attention to. And I think that's good for viewing because, yeah, they're sprinkled throughout. It's not just really solid, these two solid blocks of every big name you can think of.
What's your favorite one, Sean, since you went through that? I just actually wrote something on that.
I've already let my feelings be known. I think it's definitely Tiger, Hideki, Knox.
Yeah.
Know who I'm going to love watching is Reed, Usti, Louis, and Paul Casey.
It's a very classy group.
Yeah, Paul Casey, something else. I mean, I feel like when you start talking about, you know, best player without a major, I think he's got to be in the mix, in the conversation. He's still consistent, and I think he's got 15 top 15s in majors over the course of his career. You know, the one thing is he's never had like a really close call in a major. Like, you'd never have felt like, well, you know, Paul Casey should have won that major. Like you do with like where Ricky's had, what is he had 3 runner-ups, 4 runner-ups now, and Usti's had, you know, 4 runners-up and 1 in each major, which is pretty incredible. Do you guys have any sleepers outside of Russell Knox, Sean, that you're looking at?
What do you consider a sleeper? I don't.
Xander Schauffele is 80-1. How about, I got one. You know who else is 80-1? Lee Westwood. Is that a sleep? He's barely a golfer anymore. Is that a sleep?
Hasn't he flashed a little form recently?
Yes, yes.
He's been
Andy.
I mean, I repurchased my foreclosed property on Westwood Island recently because he's been really playing well. I mean, you can
did
see
you
it.
Get your shoes back?
Yeah. Since I'm working on a sponsorship deal to get some Air Westies sent directly to me. But you look at, you know, you watch his Instagram, you can tell he's been in the gym. He's still eating a ton. He's still eating and drinking a ton. But, you know, he's been practicing a little bit more, and he's been in the gym a lot. I think there's a resurgence here in the late 40s here for Westy. And to be honest, this could be the spot for him. You know, baked out, You know, he's so good tee to green. It's just like a matter of just putting okay, you know, just not missing so many short putts. And, you know, I feel like my life's been haunted by Lee Westwood missing four footers on Saturdays and Sundays. Like, I mean, it's just like a vivid memory of, like, you know, how he stands, you know, he's got a distinct posture over a putt. But then when he would just shove them right, you know, like they'd immediately off the club face be like right of the hole and you'd be like, oh, he missed it again. But like the way he would stand over the putt, like after, you know, it rolls by the hole, like, you know, it's like the look of a guy that knew he had no chance of making that putt. And you know, if he could somehow get around that, I mean, we'd be talking about probably, you know, the second best player of this generation.
Oh, wow.
Well, what about the big Kiwi, Ryan Fox?
That guy pounds the ball.
Yeah. What I think he's thoughts? Like the son of a rugby player or something.
He's built like a brick shithouse. He's 100
second to at the Irish Open, obviously. And then T6 at Scottish Open. So playing the links well.
What about Paul Dunn?
Yeah, I didn't even. Is he in the field? Unfortunately, I don't even know that.
He's kind of had like a sneaky, like really good year. You know, I know he's on the bubble of Ryder Cup team, but then, I mean, you're talking about a guy that was in the final group as an amateur at an Open. So I think he could be a sleeper. I think.
Uline's 150 to 1. What do we think of him?
Class player. I like it. I'm shocked at 80 to 1 is Rafa Cabrera Bayo.
Too high?
Yeah. Oh, I think I'd hop on that in a second.
That's why, yeah.
He's like I'm not a big odds guy. I finally hopped on Golf Odds for the first time we've done all this, so.
You know, I kind of like as the resurgent Danny Willett.
Yeah.
You know? Everybody left him for dead. He's back.
Is he? I don't know.
I feel like he falls into this bucket of like guys that like really good players that have gone through like the doldrums, one of which is Westy. I mean, Westy went through like 2-year period where he completely lost it in like the early 2000s. And then Henrik Stenson. I mean, Stenson had the legit shanks a couple years ago. And Willett's just the latest of it. I mean, I don't think Smiley Kaufman's coming back from it, but I think, you know, Willett is coming back. He's not. He's a great player.
Yeah, he was number one amateur in the world at one point. He just had injury and, you know, swing changes and all sorts of issues.
Yeah,
I think also the Barn Rat. The Barn Rat's kind of advancing past just being like an internet phenomenon. Like he's not just a giant guy who vapes and drives Porsches. Like he's actually played pretty well in some big events this year.
Yeah, I like the Barn Rat too. He's got a tough pairing though. I like the Barn Rat, but I don't like the high profile pairing he's in. I feel like that hinders his chances.
Sure.
It's I like Olesen too, the Thunder Bear.
Yeah. Yep.
He's you know, the only reason I know how to do those the lines through an O is because of him, and on a keyboard. But I like him. He's been, I think he's got top tens in three of his last five events, and one of them's a win. So
up to like a quarter of the field now. We're really, I mean, we'll pretty much just pick a winner if we just keep going.
I do. Who's your winner if you chips are down?
I was huge on Henrik until the report came out.
Is he hurt?
Yeah, the elbow thing really killed it. I was huge on Henrik. I was very big on strokes gained approach the green as kind of the determinant of what to pick based off of. But that being said, I'm not sure who. I think Brooks. I'm going to go Brooks. I'm all in on Brooks. I loved some of the things he said at Shinnecock. When things got out of hand and people asked him why he didn't complain, he just said, you know, when you complain, you're just allowing yourself to make excuses. I'm not going to make excuses. And then he also said that I love golf where you have to aim away from the flagstick. I feel like it tests my discipline. Like, you don't hear a lot of 28-year-olds say that, like, readily admit that or readily welcome aiming away from the stick. So he has that kind of maturity. And, yeah, I don't have a problem aiming away from flag sticks. I feel like so many guys do have a problem with that.
It's a fascinating interview with Joey D earlier. He's talking about how Koepka loves, like, the punishing workout as opposed to likes to be like beat up. It's, maybe that's the, where he gets his discipline, just throwing at middle of the green. My winner, I loved Koepka again, but you know, he came through for me last time. I am picking Patrick Reed. I think he's a different player since he won the Masters. I think, you know, we've seen him compete pretty consistently after an underwhelming major start to his majors career. You know, he's around the green. He's maybe the best, one of the best in the world. Stats back that up. He's pretty good, above average, approaching the green. You know, his one weakness is technically distance, you know, off the tee. And I think that'll be mitigated a bit this week. I think it's more of like a control and plotting game. And I just think he's a really different, confident, like, I mean, he's obviously confident, but he talked himself about how he was really nervous. He used to get nervous in majors, and he was nervous at the Masters, and how different it felt at Shinnecock since, you know, the post-Masters win. And we saw him contend there again. I just think he's like a different player now. The Masters want to do that, and I think he's got the kind of game, certainly around the green, to win this week.
Yeah, he's been on a run. T2nd at the PGA win, yeah. And what did he finish, fourth or third at Shinnecock? Fourth, I think. So, man, that's a pretty good three major run. Yeah. In the course of this podcast, I have talked myself into Sergio. So,
wow, nice.
You know, I know he hasn't had the best year. He's but he's got top 10 and then a T12th in his last two starts. And I just I think some experience. He's had so many close calls. I mean, the Open Championship is the one that you expected Sergio to get. I mean, it fits his game more so than any other major championship. So I'm rolling with the experienced guy, and Sergio moves himself a notch up, and you know, the greatest players of all time with another major win.
Can we talk real quick about Cat?
Yeah, we got to talk about Cat
quickly. I don't know if that's possible. So I heard, now this has become a big talking point. This is the best chance. The Open is the best chance for him to win another major the rest of his career. And this specific one is the best chance of the Open to win this week.
So
all living in the present.
I think I got to disagree with this week being the best chance, but the Open, I think, is the best chance for anybody because the weather can just knock out half the field. And given the draw and the weather,
yeah,
not...
I don't think we're going to have that this year.
Well, that's why I'm saying that it can't be this year. Yeah. So this year, it can't be that year because if the weather is the way it's forecasted, you know, the draw is going to be equal. So you're going to have a whole field to contend with. So I think... with regards to like the ability to hit irons and plot his way around the course, that's great. Like that's, but I mean, like the last time we saw him at Quicken Loans, he was great tee to green. I mean, I think it definitely plays his hands where he can hit irons. I think he's got a good shot this week. I would put him probably outside the top 10 in favorites, right?
Yeah, he's kind of under the radar. It's crazy. He's 25-1. This is a huge number.
I don't think Cat's ever under the radar. That is a big odds though.
We're talking about relative Tiger things. Yeah. But like he's under the radar for Tiger. And that's an enormous number for a guy who's like in effect been a top 20 player in the world this year, right? I mean, his ranking says something different, but his play is that of like a top 20 player in the world. And for him to, you know, he had much lower numbers when he was like his back was a mess and he had no chance. Like he has a chance this week. 25-1 just seems really high for a Tiger in the realm of Tiger.
I mean, I agree with all of it. I think the Open for so many reasons that we've talked about fits him so well and fits him well for years because like he talked about, you can, even when he gets, you know, older, you can, you don't have to hit it as far, you can run it up. And I was trying to prepare this contrarian take where it's like, yeah, he's won three Opens, but two were to St. Andrews. And then I pulled up his record and he has 9 top 10s in 19 starts. And that, I mean, really 9 top 10s basically in 15 starts where he had a chance, discounting the amateur starts. And then 2015, I think, was an anomaly. So you got basically three quarters of his starts, he's finishing top 10 at the Open. It's a great tournament for him. I think it kind of gets the gears flowing. And I think maybe because there's so much enthusiasm for it and so much creativity, it maybe takes away a little bit of the nerves, I think. It's a very amateur psychology take, but I think that, I don't know, I think that he feels more comfortable there maybe than anywhere else because he knows that he can do things differently, he can be creative, and he doesn't have to, you don't have to play perfect at the Open, you just have to play smart.
Yeah, I think the Open is a much more like instinctual golf. It's yeah. not a, you know, there's this ongoing debate between, you know, is golf science or is it art? And I think when you're out in the Open Championship with the conditions, the weather, you know, the firmness, like it becomes so much less scientific and so much more about feel and just, you know, knowing how to play and just, you know, proper golf. And I think that's why you see, you know, the list of players, obviously you get some fluky winners just because of weather and stuff, but you get, you know, a real class leaderboard and class players almost every time out with the Open. And I think, you know, that's how it fits Tiger so well, is that when the chips are down and, you know, like we saw it so much through his career, is like when he, you know, when his back's up against the wall, but it's all about just hitting that shot. He was, you know, one of the class players and always came up with the shot because it was like, you know, it was kind of like golf in your childhood when you're, you know, playing and you're racing against darkness. Like you can't see anything. You're just swinging and hitting the shot. It's not, you know, you kind of, I think you lose that a little bit when it's just, you know, kind of point and shoot and all numbers based and with the green books, like it's become so scientific and going somewhere where it's so firm and you can get a bad bounce out of the blue brings back the art of it a little bit more.
Yeah, I think there was something a couple of years ago that was really telling when Phil switched to Andrew Getson, he was talking about how like he really basically felt he had the genesis, like the bulk of what they were trying to do down. Like he had that part of swing, and now he just had to learn kind of and get back into the finer hand motions to create the little, you know, different shots, hit it a little bit higher, cut it a little bit, draw it a little bit. And you know, we look at golf swings as like this macro thing. We break down swing plane and we look at the big motions because that's what you can catch on camera. But, you know, impact is a fraction of a second, and so much of it and what talent, I think what a lot of it is just that little bit extra ability to, you know, control it and manipulate it and save it sometimes and work it sometimes with the hands. And so I think you get over here and, you know, Tiger's working on that, and Tiger's, you know, he's got – trying to hit fine shots that take this little, you know, extra hand motion that kind of, like you were saying, put the artistry back in it. And so he's been so swing centric, you know, he's changing things up the past few years. And I think that, you know, going back to maybe just playing golf again, I think helps him get out of that, you know, basically the whole thing of playing golf versus playing golf swing type deal.
So Will Knight's, you know, Ben Curtis, Hunter Mahan, and Mike Weir were all in the top 10 the last time the Open was at Carnoustie. Of these three, who would you be most surprised if they won another major?
Was it Ben Curtis, Mahan, and Weir?
Yeah.
Oh, my. I mean, it has to be Ben Curtis. I don't think he's
no
man.
Way.
He's
we're gonna count senior major wins in this.
I think it's still Ben Curtis.
Oh, no way. But Benny boy, I mean, he came out of nowhere to win the first time. He'd come out of nowhere again.
That always offends me. He was the number one amateur in the world at Kent State for a while. And then everyone's like, oh, he came out of nowhere.
I'm from Northeast Ohio. I know about his roots. I know him. I'm just telling you, he'd come out of nowhere again. What was he ranked in the world? Like 600th or something? Mike Weir has no chance to win. At any level, and I'm in for a major, a club championship. Mike Weir, God bless the guy. You know, he seems like a very nice individual. Was a Hall of Famer, maybe incredibly, you know, great at one point. He hits like a wounded duck, 235 yards.
This pod could
exempt to the U.S. Senior Women's.
Okay. Wow, jeez.
I think of those three, I like him. I'm a big fan, you know. I just, when it's gone, it's gone. You just can't, I think he would be the most unlikely.
I agree. Mike Weir has no chance.
Also, Hunter Mahan, the original Monster ambassador on tour.
That's right.
You always have to wonder about the underlying motives of Porath.
Yeah.
You know, this comes out after his rant about Weir trying to take all the spotlight off Mahan. I think I could see Ben Curtis becoming an icon on the senior tour. You know, becoming the guy that, you know, just has a resurgence at age 50.
Do we know if he plays golf anymore?
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
Are we really? Are you sure?
I mean, I'm sure he goes out and plays golf. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
might not have played for money in a while.
His last start was the 2007 Texas Open. He WD'd. He played two events in 2017. He's played nowhere in 2018.
Hey, he's just getting primed. Just starting like a rocky like you know, training for the senior tour. So
also, Ben Curtis won three more tour events. He finished runner up in a PGA Championship and a Players. Like,
he had a career.
He had a good little career there.
For sure.
So we got overrated. Let's go with Vandeveld's collapse. Is it overrated or underrated? And this is from Ernesto.
I think it's become overrated. I think it's become mythologized in a way that we just, that's how we do. We tend to get carried away with things. Of course, it's an incredible turn. It just finishes to a turn. But I think it's been mythologized a little too much just because, like, it had the taking your shoes off and socks off and getting in the burn. There's just, like, a lot of visuals with it that have just added. I don't know. I think it's overrated. Or maybe I'm just fatigued by it all this week.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting walking around here. Still when people are walking around 18, you constantly just hear people like going, okay, and then he was there, and then he hit it to there, and then it bounced off this thing, you know, and it's still the big talking point, but I kind of agree with the overrated. Like, you still see the photo of him in the burn with his pants rolled up, you know, every time we come to Carnoustie, and I'm going overrated. I appreciate that in Ryan Lavender's oral history of the whole thing, Vandeveld, for the first time I had seen, finally admit that, like, when the night was over, he went into his hotel room, and I believe that he was in his closet, he said, bawling. And, like, I never bought the whole, like, oh, I'm French, it's just a game, it does not matter. I was like, there's no way, man. And so I was so glad to finally hear him admit that he just broke down after the night was over. I mean, I feel bad for him that he did, but it had to be. I mean, there's no way that it wasn't a big deal, but it's overrated.
I'm going underrated. It's the craziest collapse in any championship golf history. I mean,
yeah, but now we're going all like revisionist history on it. They're like, well, actually, he was really unlucky because, like, if he hit this pole and the ball and the pole and all, and I'm like, yeah, but you know how you're not unlucky? You hit 7-iron into the fairway, or 8-iron into the fairway.
He needed to make I'll never forget it. It's one of the, you know, whether you like it or not, like, one of the most vivid golf memories I've ever had, you know?
Yeah, but it was kind of a goofy end to a goofy week because the setup was crazy. I mean, it was the setup was an abomination to the width and angle school. There was zero of both. The fairways were 4 yards wide. So, I don't know. I think that's what sours it on me. It was almost like the deserving ending to the week that they had there.
All right. Overrated, underrated. Adam Scott's career. And this is given the expectations from Tommy Gufano.
I think we...
His career. So, like, his resume, I guess?
His career.
Number one in the world, the Players and the Masters. It's pretty good. But what was he, number one in the world for, like, a month? Less?
Maybe an hour.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to go underrated just because, I mean, we base so much on, like, what the swing looks like, and he's a good-looking guy. Like, if he was 20 pounds heavier and he had a hitch in his swing... You'd be like, oh my gosh, what an amazing, you know, like, there's so much more to golf than just what your swing looks like. I mean, I know two handicaps that have good looking swings, but they're not going to crack an egg on tour. And so I think we just, like, the poor guy, because he's
ridiculously good looking, and his swing is on perfectly on plane throughout. Like, we expect him to win everything. So
the poor guy.
I just think that it's just the visuals are there, so we think, oh, he should win so much. But in reality, I think it's been a good career. I think just the expectations are so high because, again, the looks and the swing.
Yeah, I'd probably say for the same reason, it's overrated. I think, like, he just gets too much credit for being good looking and have a great swing.
Yeah, but number one in the world, a major of players, I don't know.
It's a good question.
I'm going to go, he's underrated. I think I just did the math real quick. In his professional career, he's top 10 in 35% of his starts.
That's what you get. You throw us to the wolves first and you get out the calculator while we're talking.
Yeah.
And you come back.
I come back, you know, do some quick math. And I mean, that's pretty damn good. And in the longevity of his career, I think is the other thing. Yeah. Is like, he's been a force in the game and a favorite. Like, I mean, how many, I think right now is where we're getting, like, even till last year, but this year he's underperformed compared to what we're used to. But, you know, where he was like every single major, he was a top 10 favorite for, you know, maybe 12, 13 years. It's a pretty good career.
Do you care about the anchoring thing?
What?
Do you care about the anchoring thing kind of changing his career?
Yeah, I don't know. I think he had a lot of good years post-anchoring. I mean, sure. He had, you know, he was end of the year in 2016 ranked 7th in the world. And he won twice that year. So
back to back, right?
Yeah.
He went almost around. I don't know.
So I think one of the things that, I mean, we might look back eventually on the anchoring role and say it was like the worst role ever made because they might, you know, pull it back. Who knows? But the I think he was underrated, and when you look at it from like he gift wrapped a open championship for my boy Big Earn, you know. That, I mean,
yeah, there were a few years there where he was like a consistent major. I mean, like what Brooks is doing right now, we talk about, like, he was doing that for a little bit.
Sure.
And I think everyone's like, oh, if only he could putt, he'd win so much. And it's like, yeah, if you took any player and made their weakest part of their game a strength, they'd win a ton. But that's why they don't, because golf is hard and nobody except Tiger is good at everything for an extended period of time.
So overrated, underrated, the Irish and Scottish Open.
Underrated. I think they're fantastic. As what? As like prep for the Open?
Yeah, sure.
Oh.
I don't know. Whatever you want it to be.
I think they're underrated. I think they're amazing. They're part of what makes July the best month of golf. And I love getting up, having coffee, and having stuff resolved by noon. I think they're awesome. I love both events. And same reason I love the Open. It's just a different look. I think we tend to kind of overweight, you know, any results and show of form and all this stuff. Like, as soon as Ricky hits a good shot, people are like, oh, he's winning the British Open. You know, as soon as he, you know, rolls into putt it, it's all in. It's like, oh, he's winning. It's like, I don't know. I think we might overweight the effects of playing well there. But I love them as tournaments on their own.
I think this is what got me in trouble last time with our controversial overrated, underrated episode a few months ago. But because I was making my take based on the golf hipster crowd, which I'm not cool, so I don't think I'm a part of. But
you're part of it, I think.
I think it's more getting to the flavor of the age. We just, with social media, we just take something great and just beat it to death and just try to wring every last bit of content out of it. And there's that always that danger. But that being said, I think it is great to be able to get up early and watch golf. Unfortunately, I don't have cable, so I can't. I don't watch them because I can't. But if I did have cable, I would watch them, and it would be quite enjoyable. So I'll say there's no way I can say overrated. So I'll say underrated, but I don't know. I do think they're in danger of just us just beating them to death because they are so good. And that's just what we do with anything that's good.
I wish they weren't back to back, and I know it's scheduled that way for a reason and for prep, but it would be nice to just get it every. I don't know. I'm a big fan of the idea of like this world tour, because like I think the Irish and the Scottish Open are so cool, and I think you should. But like having them, you know, 2 weeks in a row, it diminishes. I guess it. I mean, it absolutely kills the PGA Tour those 2 weeks because they get all the best players playing them. But it would be cool to have it more. You know, like it. I mean, if I was running golf, I feel like we should have a monthly tournament in the British Islands, you know?
Yeah, but I think it's okay for the European Tour to win like certain stretches of the calendar. I mean, I'm okay with that. I think it's good. I think it's healthy for the game. I think it's healthy for both tours. Like, I think it's okay for them to win a couple weeks, just because it makes so much sense. Because after the U.S. Open, most European guys are headed back to Europe anyway. So I don't know. I'm totally cool with like the European Tour winning those weeks, because it makes sense to have Irish and Scottish Opens on length courses right before the Open Championship.
All right, last overrated, underrated, kilt.
Overrated. I have respect for, you know, native Scots who, you know, that's part of their history wearing them. I just think you get a lot of idiots that are trying to, you know, show off wearing them. I think, like, it's just become, like, a thing for, like, people to, like, put a sign, look at me. And there's a lot of people who are, like, faking it and wearing kilts just to kind of, for the show and the attention. So, overrated.
Yeah, it's kind of like with St. Pat, I know they're different countries, but it's kind of like or like sync from a national holiday of like some pride for the country it originated in to just an American drinking festival because we bastardize it. I think that kind of is what happens with kilts.
You're an overrated, yeah. Huh?
Right. Yeah, it's nothing against kilts. It's just that if you're not wearing them because you come from a Scottish heritage and it's like a point of cultural pride for you, then you shouldn't be wearing it.
Yeah, I'm going to go overrated. Not in on them. Yeah. I think they're overrated. You know, what gets me is like when people are like, "Oh, look at that guy in a kilt," you know?
Yeah, that's the thing.
How often does that happen in Chicago?
I don't know. I just feel like it's like if somebody's wearing a kilt, everybody's like, "Oh, look at that guy in a kilt." It's like, you know, what's the big deal? He's wearing a kilt, you know?
Well, and that's why he's trying to elicit that reaction. That's why he's doing it. You're just playing it in his hands.
Yeah, I'm not one like that. I just take it for what it's worth, and I don't pay him any more attention than I would somebody wearing pants or shorts.
Right.
All right.
I'm always just a little bit nervous that he's actually not wearing anything under there, because there was a rowdy group of probably guys that fit in the category that Brendan and I were discussing, who were in an Irish bar that DJ Pihowski and I used to frequent in Orlando, and they were getting rowdy, and we found out the hard way that he was not wearing anything under his kilt, so that soured me as well to the whole kilt situation.
Orlando's a natural place to wear a kilt. It's like, seems like a natural habitat, and that's what I'm talking about.
That's why you should put, it's the same reason you put Spaniards in big techs wear.
Yeah, exactly. That's how they're overrated. It's forced, it's dumb. And the people you know who wear kilts are you generally going to be terrible people. Now, I apologize for all the kind of, this is a part of Scottish heritage. You know, I'm not lumping in the Scots. That's just a part of their heritage.
No, you're defending the Scots.
Yes. Yeah, I'm saying it's been co-opted.
Canadians, though.
Co-opted by a bunch of D-bags. So.
Actually, a lot of Canada is, there's a large Scottish-Canadian connection. Nova Scotia means New Scotland, because a lot of them moved to Scotland, I think, or to Canada, I think, during the potato famine, which also hit Scotland. And so you have, I don't know, you've offended one people while defending another, but there's going to be a lot of overlap.
So you got a good 5 minutes on kilts.
Yeah. It's I have to acknowledge this, because it, you know, we talked about Fleetwood. Tommy Pelto also wanted to know, what's your favorite Fleetwood Mac song?
I don't have one.
Oh, very sad.
Landslide?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the one I know.
No. I think I'm going Dreams.
Dreams is good.
Yeah. Good. I like that second and new song, too.
I had a Fleetwood Mac phase, and that's no longer.
Fleetwood Mac, overrated, underrated?
overrated.
I'm not qualified to take part in this. I really don't know.
I guess stop having non music fans on my pod.
Every time. Music.
I know. Smart. I'd say underrated on overrated.
Doesn't have cable. Doesn't have listen to music.
I mean, I listen to music. It's not Fleetwood Mac. I don't know what to tell you.
All right. Well, that's disappointing, Sean. Pop it on Spotify when you can't sleep tonight.
I will.
All right, guys.
Also, no Pandora in the UK. Not that it matters. No Pandora in the UK. Very disappointed to find out. Not allowed.
That's rough.
Might be why the Brexit happened. I don't know.
All right.
We'll enjoy an open, and we'll maybe talk to you guys on Sunday or Monday.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
All right. Get some sleep, Sean.
All right.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.